The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Boost Your IQ, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas, Mr. David Cohen of Blessed Memory.
There's probably no nation on earth that has valued and continues to value intelligence and intellectual achievement like the Jews. For thousands of years, the wish and dream of every Jewish mother was that as a child should grow up to be a Talmud Chacham, a great scholar of the Hebrew Bible and Talmud, who embodied not only the ethical and spiritual ideal of the Jewish people, but the intellectual ideal as well. Respect for intellectual achievement, by the way, was not restricted to the study of Torah. Many are the luminaries of our history, from Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, King Solomon, Mar Shmuel, Maimonides, Rabbi Abraham Zakuta, Rabbeinu Eliyahu, the Gaon of Vilna, to name only a few, who mastered not only the depths of the Torah, or Talmud, but were well accomplished in the secular science of their day as well. Maimonides' medical treatises became standard texts in the medical colleges of the Middle Ages. Rabbi Zakuta's maps enabled Columbus to discover the New World. In fact, according to many authorities, scientific knowledge is considered to be an adjunct to the study of Torah. According to Maimonides, the study of science brings one closer to the realization and appreciation of the awesome genius who designed this world. According to the Vilna Gaon, scientific and mathematical knowledge only deepen our understanding of the Torah and Talmud. From the 19th century and on, however, paralleling the spiritual upheaval in the non-Jewish world, secular intellectual accomplishment became divorced from the study of Talmud. The great modern secular intellectual giants of Jewish extraction, Einstein, Freud, Marx, to name only a few, as well as the great musical geniuses of Jewish extraction, Mendelssohn, Meyerbeer, Mahler, Offenbach, were far removed from their Talmudic roots. Yet even today in the secular environment, intellectual accomplishment continues to hold an inordinate role in Jewish life. This reminds me of the story describing the hypothetical scene of the inauguration of the first Jewish president of the United States of America. Imagine, if you will, a Jew was finally elected president. His proud mother is seated on the dais together with the political leaders of this country and heads of state from throughout the whole world. As he is raising his hand to be sworn in, his mother turns to the man on her right, giving him a nudge and saying, "You see that young man up there being sworn in? His brother is a doctor." But how important is it to be intellectually gifted? Although there's a strong correlation between IQ scores and academic performance and professional occupation, there's only the slightest correlation between test scores and income. Some of our best and brightest only eke out a living, whereas others whose academic and intellectual levels are far inferior manage to achieve great fame and fortune. It reminds me of the true story of the professor who addressed his class the first day of the semester. He told the class about the guidelines for teaching that he was given by the administration. He was told, "Be very careful how you treat your A students, because in all likelihood, they're eventually going to be your doctors and lawyers." be also careful how you treat your B plus students. They're going to be your computer programmers and accountants. But most important, treat your C and D students with great respects, because they eventually will be the greatest donors to this institution. There's, in fact, another true story. Of a graduate of Princeton Engineering School. He originally came from Hong Kong. His last name was Wu. He graduated at the bottom of his class. And quite dejected and ready to go back after graduation to his homeland, back to China, to Hong Kong, he had a talk with the dean of men of the school. The dean tried to boost his spirits. He says, "Don't worry how you grew, what level you graduate in the class. The important thing is go back home and make $1 million." Well, he went back home and made $1 million many times over. He thought of a brilliant plan. Communist China is a country which is blessed with a large population and many natural resources. It's hampered, though, by ideology. And because of the ideological constraints, China was really never able to fully utilize its potential. Wu hit upon a brilliant plan, which he suggested to the Chinese government. And it went as follows. "I know you dislike capitalism, private ownership, but I have an idea for you. I will supervise the building of immense industrial projects, products that will ensure you profits, will provide jobs internally, and provide income not only for the factory and its owner, but through export as well. I only ask one thing, that the profits of the first 5 years of the factory should go to me. I will train all the management, the workers. I will set up the system. I will set up the whole selling and marketing process, so after I leave, everything will be in place and will continue on." They bought into that idea. After all, he was just a consultant, a very highly paid consultant. And he went on to build one factory after the other and became a multi-billionaire. He was so thankful to Princeton University, who not only educated him, but gave him the inspiration to go on to make that fortune, that he donated $150 million to Princeton University. My understanding is, in Princeton, they don't call him Wu, they call him Wow. Evidently, though, there are other factors that translate into success, such as motivation, personality, the intuitive knowledge we call street smarts, and the factors that we discussed in the previous lecture that go into the category of mazel, or luck. Does high scoring on IQ tests ensure a happier married life, satisfaction from your job or children? Does it ensure having a greater moral or spiritual life? I personally doubt it. Allow me to read you a letter which I quoted in a previous lecture last year, written by a Holocaust survivor. "On the first day of the new school year, all the teachers in one private school received the following note from their principal. "Dear teacher, I am a survivor of a concentration camp. My eyes saw what no man should witness. Gas chambers built by learned engineers. Children poisoned by educated physicians, infants killed by trained nurses, women and babies shot and burned by high school and college graduates. So I am suspicious of education. My request is, help your students become human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters skilled psychopaths, educated Eichmanns. Reading, writing, and arithmetic are important only if they serve to make our children more humane. Yet despite the limitations of intelligence, we have a whole auditorium filled with people who want to boost their IQ. Aside from those who are still in school and want to increase the type of intelligence that's measured by IQ scores in order to do well academically, most of you are interested in the subject because you harbor within you that Jewish feeling that knowledge and intelligence are its own reward. The importance and reward of intelligence, what it consists of, and what is to be achieved is the subject of tonight's lecture. I've divided this lecture into 12 parts, each part beginning with a letter that spells out the acronym intelligence. You see that on your first page. We begin, the I of intelligence is intellect. In the eyes of the Talmud, and here the first quote is from the Talmud, from a Gemara Nedorim, Mem Aleph, Amud Aleph, and 41a. Abaye said, we have a tradition that no one is poor save he who lacks knowledge. Because poverty, in the Jewish sense, is poor of knowledge. And the Talmud goes on to quote a proverb from Israel. He who has this knowledge, intelligence, has everything. He who lacks this, what has he? Has one acquired this, what does he lack? And has he not acquired this, what does he possess? In the eyes of the Talmud, being knowledgeable is important in its own right. And knowledge, we don't mean trivia. We mean wisdom. And there's an interesting parallel to the Talmud statement. As you all well know, there's much research presently going on regarding near-death experiences. There are literally millions of people alive in this country who claim to have left their body during a period when they were close to death. A large group of these claim to have gone through a tunnel into a bright spiritual world. Not only do they describe their experience in vivid and uncannily similar detail, but the experience leaves them markedly changed forever. Those who claim to have experienced going into the spiritual realm maintain that the two most important things in life are love, the sharing and caring kind, and knowledge. Evidently, according to them, the soul gains knowledge after death, and there exist universities in the spiritual world. This, by the way, closely parallels the Talmudic concept of Misifta de Rikia, the yeshiva of on high, the yeshiva of the spiritual world. So the first idea of I, of intellect, is the importance of gaining knowledge for its own sake. Knowledge in a sense of wisdom, appreciation of the world. It's interesting that it's not just how much you've acquired, but your attitude towards wisdom, how you value wisdom. The Greek word for a wise man is a philosoph, the root of our word philosopher. It comes from philo, which means to love, soph, knowledge. We find a parallel statement in Ovos, Mishnah in Ovos. Ezehu chocham, who is considered a wise man, halomed mikol adam, who learns from everyone, who tries to seek knowledge and picks up pearls of wisdom from this person or that person. It's not just the gross amount that you know, but it's the attitude towards wisdom and how you value wisdom. So the first part of this is having wisdom and having intelligence is probably one of the greatest goods. Of course, balanced in with with the heights of morality and one's ethics. The other part here is the question, well, what's my limit? Is intelligence genetically determined? Am I destined to be only so smart? We have there's a statement of the Talmud which we quote here. This is paragraph B, the beginning on page 2. That at the time of conception, as the fetus is beginning to form, it's predetermined what kind of life that child is destined to live. And this is something that we covered in the first lecture of this year's series about how to change your luck. One of those things that is predetermined is the level of your intelligence. There's another quote from the Talmud that it seems to be family related. If the father is intelligent, there's a great likelihood the child is going to be intelligent. What happens if you want to break out? You know, you not only do you want to reach your potential, but you want to exceed your potential. And here we have it's truly an important Jewish concept, and that goes to the N. We got I of intelligence and intellect. The N is nerve. If one has chutzpah, it works. And here we quote two sources that you have on page 2. One is from a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Kuf Hei Amud Aleph, 105a. That impudence, if you really want it and you really push, there's a good chance you'll get it. And as we quote the second quote, there's a Gemara in Makas and Yud Amud Beis in 10b. It says, the road that you choose is the road that God helps you on. And let me tell you, chutzpah comes naturally to Jews. It's a real Jewish trait. You probably all were thinking that only New Yorkers have chutzpah. Huh? But it really comes natural to all Jews. In fact, let me tell you a story. It's a true story. I was going to California. I was sitting on the plane. And I was seated next to a cardiologist. And we began schmoozing. We began talking. And he had the New Yorker magazine. He was leafing it through. Began to talk. He says, Rabbi, let me tell you a story. I did my residency in the University of Kentucky in Lexington, Kentucky. I'm an avid reader of the New Yorker magazine. So I went into a drugstore one day, looking in their magazine section. Someone from the store went over, you know, in the South, they're very polite and very gracious. And he asked me, he says, if I could be of any help. He says, looking through the magazine, he says, yeah, he says, I'm trying to find the New Yorker. And he thought for a second, ah, you probably mean Bob. He's not really a New Yorker. He's just pushy. The Talmud, though, calls Jews as a class Azin Shubu'umos, the most fierce, bold, those who possess the most chutzpah of any nation. And in fact, the Talmud goes on to say that if the Torah had not been given to the Jews, there would be no nation that would be able to withstand their fierceness. A very interesting story happened 150 years ago. In Russia, the Russian government began to implement measures to assimilate their Jewish populace. They had a Jewish problem. And they started measures to discourage the traditional mode of Jewish education and to encourage more secular and university education amongst Jews. And one of the rabbis spoke to the minister of education in Russia and told him, he said, you better tread lightly, because that which holds the Jews in line is the Torah. You take the Torah away from these Jews, they'll make a revolution and throw you out. Some years later, his words came true. The Russian Revolution was created by and large by Jews. So I is intellect, the idea of the importance of intellect, and the idea to a certain extent we have a certain genetic disposition to intellect. However, N is that if you really want it and you have the nerve, you can change it. And now, which takes us to the next, is T of intellect, which is Talmud. Let me preface this. What is the intelligence that is measured in an IQ test? That's the name of this lecture, is How to Boost Your IQ. Alfred Binet, the pioneer researcher of intelligence and the one who devised the original test that later developed into the Stanford-Binet IQ test, defined intelligence as consisting of four parts. First, perception and knowledge of the outside world and comprehension and analysis of that knowledge. In other words, looking at something, reading something, and understanding that. That's the first part. The second is based on an understanding of the original factor of knowledge. Let's call that A. We must have the ability to expand and compare that knowledge and understand how it applies to another situation or case, B. In other words, I have first the knowledge and I want to expand that knowledge. This he called invention. That's the ability to expand your knowledge. The second operation cannot be performed, however, without our knowing or sensing what direction our inquiry is going to take. In other words, even before we make comparisons and expand one bit of knowledge, we have to have a third element, a sense of focus and direction of what we are looking for. The fourth element of intelligence is judgment or censorship. The ability to reject unfit ideas and embrace those that make sense. Let me just give you an example. It just comes to mind. The Wright brothers were amongst the, not the only ones, but amongst the pioneers of aviation. And what they did was borrowed ideas of gliders, which preceded them, the idea of motors, which preceded them, and applied them into creating a machine that will fly, a heavier-than-air machine that will fly. They had to understand the principles of gliders. They had to understand the principles of wings, of motors. That began the idea of this knowledge. That was what they started off with. They had to apply it, this knowledge, and invent a certain form of placing where to place the what kind of a motor and where to place the motor and how to build the wings and how to balance the wing and the machine in order to create this machine. They had the original knowledge. They had the sense of this image of where they wanted to go with it. And then they went and said, hey, this perhaps will take us here. And they may have thought of one design, nixed it. That's the censorship. And thought of another design, nixed that. And kept on going. Sometimes one nixes something mentally. Other times one has to go through the experiments. There are hundreds and hundreds of experiments Edison made until he finally developed the light bulb. Again, he had a basic knowledge. He knew the idea of at least the possibility of that a wire could glow. He was familiar with vacuum, was familiar with glass. He didn't know exactly what substance to go with. He took the existing knowledge, had this direction of where he wanted to apply it, and decided, let's try this. Didn't work. Tried another thing and another thing. I mean, that's why Edison is the author of the statement that genius or intelligence is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. But this is the censorship process, because you're not, very often you just don't hit it the first time. So again, according to Binet, it's perception and knowledge, invention, the ability to apply it, a sense of focus and direction. This intuition, what am I going to do with this? Where is this going to go? Which combines my basic knowledge and leading it to B. And fourth is, once I have something, to test it out. Does it really work? And if it doesn't, start over again. In the words of Binet, written in 1909, comprehension, invention, direction, and censorship, intelligence is contained in these four words. It parallels, by the way, very interestingly, Kabbalistically, and we have the same in Jewish literature, we have the idea of Chochmah, Bina, and Das. Chochmah is the basic knowledge. Bina is the understanding of it, it's the analysis of that knowledge, it's the expansion of that knowledge. Similar to the word bone, which means to build. Das is the final product. After you've gone through this process, you've got it. In some way, the standard IQ test measures this ability. It is the ability to think. I've reproduced for you a sampling of an IQ test for you to look at your leisure. It's in the back of your pages, if you haven't looked at it before. Hopefully, if we have time at the end of this class, we'll go over the whole test. Can performance on a standard IQ test be improved by practice? The results of many studies point conclusively that this is so. In fact, there are several books designed specifically to help you develop those crucial thinking skills that are tested on standard IQ tests. One of them has the title of this lecture, How to Boost Your IQ, and it's written by John Bremner. If your whole desire is to be a member of Mensa, the select group of people who are able to achieve unusually high scores on their IQs, on their IQ tests, then this book is likely to be very helpful. In fact, this is what Mr. Bremner did to gain entry to Mensa. The book contains practice tests and helpful hints for improving your vocabulary and reasoning skills. How all of this translates into improving your reasoning skills on a day-to-day basis is not all that clear. And how all that translates into gaining real wisdom, and that's not just scoring well on IQ tests, is even less clear. There is, however, a tried and tested Jewish method to increase one's thinking skills on a day-to-day basis. But they're also designed to access the most precious commodity on earth, wisdom. What is it? The Talmud. The Talmud, which is probably the classic work of Jewish literature, deals with the application of wisdom to life's challenges on a day-to-day basis. It deals with textual analysis, logic, categorization, and problem-solving, touching virtually every aspect of the human experience. In its methodology, it takes nothing for granted. Every idea is challenged and questioned. The idea that belief has to be logically justified is one of the best basic premises of the Talmud. It is this approach that is carried over to Jews who no longer study Talmud or practice its teachings. There's a story which is told of Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud, after he developed his very controversial theories, was dismissed from his post in the medical college. And for several years, he had a very difficult time. Eventually, his theories gained wide acceptance. But he was asked, what gave him the stamina, what gave him the koyach, the power to withstand all that pressure during those very lean, mean, difficult years? And his answer, which is really shows Jewish chutzpah, his answer was, you know, I'm Jewish. When I went to the university in Vienna, it was the first time that I realized that I was a member of the thinking minority and not the gullible majority. I guess that attitude and that chutzpah is what kept him going. The idea that you cannot take anything for granted, that everything has to be logically justified, is really the basic premise of the Talmud. However, the true study of the Talmud is a lifetime's work, demanding total involvement. And those who were the great Talmudic scholars of old were people that were totally dedicated. But even if one is not a student of the Talmud in the classic sense, there are many lessons one could learn from the methodology that one could implement in day-to-day life. I would just suggest, how does one increase one's intelligence using that methodology? Just as you are. First, we all read. Very often we see words we don't understand. Our working vocabulary in English is much smaller than the actual English vocabulary. And quite often we see words we don't understand. Don't skip over it. To the extent that you build a vocabulary, you're building your intelligence. It says always keep a good dictionary, perhaps Webster's Intercollegiate Dictionary. There's a good, handy dictionary by your side. If you don't want to know what it means, look it up. When one studies Talmud, and the Talmud is written in Aramaic, which even to a student of the Talmud, there is a working vocabulary and there are arcane words that only come up a few times in the Talmud. And very often when you come to words you just don't know. And what you do is you look it up. In the back of the Talmud, invariably there are printed words, of difficult words. Rashi translates them into French. There is called a Meturgam, a translation into German. There's, of course, a better translations that have come out in the last century. But again, the first part is when you read and you don't understand a word, don't skip over it. Don't expect, well, you understand it from its context. Be an active reader. Take a dictionary. Second is be discriminating. Don't believe everything you read. Ask yourself, you're reading an article, you're reading an editorial, is the argument or conclusion that the author makes really warranted? Is there another way of looking at it? This is a very Talmudic method, but it's a way, if you keep on asking those questions, you get a lot more from your reading. Three, be sure you really understand the material before you go on. You read something. Did you really understand that? That sounded impressive. Could you tell it over? This methodology, by the way, was used in one of the most important studies of intelligence that was conducted about a half a century ago by Benjamin Bloom and Lois Broder from the University of Chicago. They wanted to find the difference of what's the difference between high aptitude students and low aptitude students. They found that there exist two problems with students of low aptitude. One, there is what they called one-shot thinking. In other words, they jump to conclusions rather than extended sequential construction of understanding. Because the difference of someone of high aptitude is he knows how you reach this conclusion. This makes sense because of A, B, C, D. There was a laziness in thinking of those of low aptitude. They would just automatically jump to D, without going through the steps. And secondly, which we'll touch on the next topic here, there's a willingness to allow gaps of knowledge to exist. They're happy. It doesn't bother them that they don't know something. In effect, an attitude of indifference toward achieving an accurate and complete comprehension of situations and relations. These two researchers developed a successful remedial program. A set of problems was selected, which they contrasted the approaches of good and poor students. In other words, they asked good students, how would you approach this? And the good students wrote down what their methodology is. Then they tested the poor students. And after explaining to them, that intelligence is like training for tennis. You don't necessarily get it at once, but if you keep on repeating the methodology, train yourself, you can get it. And they taught them the thinking process of the high aptitude students. Now, first, they would ask them the questions. Invariably, they would get it wrong. And then they would say, but how should you have thought this through? And then they went back and taught them how to think this through. And they worked through the process. And they got amazingly good results. After this training program, even many years later on, these students did remarkably well in school. So the T of intelligence, which you call the Talmud, is the notion that one has to not only just gain knowledge, one has to be a critical thinker. One has to know the material, not to fool oneself. One has to have a full vocabulary, has to make sure that one knows fully the subject until they go on. Learning Talmud, though, has another benefit. It's probably a mystical or a supernatural benefit. And here we quote on page 3 of Talmud that there's actually a blessing that he who studies Torah is given that ability. It quotes a verse in Proverbs, Ani chochma v'shechanti orma, I, the Torah, am the embodiment of wisdom, and have made subtlety my dwelling. I give the blessing. Those who study me are given that blessing. So we have eye, intellect, and nerve. You can change it. T, Talmud, refers to the process of thinking. E is erudition. You have to gain knowledge. You can have all the ability to think in the world, but you have to use it. It's a tool. Intelligence is a tool. People who score well on IQ tests have the tools, but not necessarily do they have wisdom. As we stated before, the idea of erudition, the idea of knowledge, is a question of attitude. Because realistically, there's so much to know in this world. It's impossible to know everything. What you can do, though, is want to know. As we said, philosopher is he who has a love of knowledge. Unfortunately, outside of the university setting, generally in our community, in the Jewish community, we have very few models of people who have this love of learning. university education for most is really only a tool to make money. Even those who are rabbis, who put in many dedicated years in study, but once they enter the rabbinate, are overwhelmed with the problems of administration and ministering to their flock. You know, there's a even the congregations who employ the rabbis, because they're so used to this model of a rabbi who spends so little time studying and so much time helping his congregation at weddings, at funerals, and making shiva calls, going to the hospital, they're often very shocked when they see a rabbi who spends time learning. There's a story, I don't know if it's true or just apocryphal, of congregants who came to a rabbi's home in the middle of the night, must have been 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, that they had an extremely pressing problem. They came to the rabbi's study, and the rabbi had books piled up, and he was busy studying. After the rabbi helped them with their problem, the people asked them, "What are all these books for?" And he says, "Well, you know, I'm still studying, I'm still growing." They fired him on the spot. We expected a rabbi who's finished. If you don't know all your stuff, you're not a rabbi for our congregation. In Europe, very often, the rabbonim, the rabbis, were not the speakers, were not the orators of the congregation. In fact, their communities had magidim, they had professional speakers who conducted eulogies and who spoke to the community. The rabbis were chosen because of their scholarship and dedication, not necessarily for their speaking ability. It's very hard to find a person who's so multifaceted and who has the ability to speak well as being a dedicated scholar. So even in our communities, it's very hard to find a model of someone who is a lifelong student. In other words, someone who, besides doing what he is doing in life and making the living that he's made, has this love of learning and who's always wants to increase that knowledge base. But from the Jewish viewpoint, it really is of prime importance. So the T we had Talmud was the process, E, erudition, is gaining knowledge. So after we went through four initial subjects here. We went to the importance of having intelligence, the importance to stretch yourself, nerve, to get that intelligence. The idea that intelligence consists really of two parts, the process of thinking and the love of knowledge through a whole lifetime of gaining intelligence. Now I'd like to touch upon what are the things that are going to help you gain that intelligence. What are the extras besides the fact you want to do it? And you're going to start thinking critically or practice it and read. What are the other things that could help you? Which brings us to L, which is lifestyle. One important part of lifestyle. Here we have really two L's. I'd like to go down to the part here on the bottom of the page, which deals with the idea of what your mood is. If you're in a good mood, you think better. And this is, we quote on the bottom of the page from Maimonides. It says, on the gaiety and liveliness have the opposite effect. I'm quoting from Maimonides, one of his medical treatises. They gladden the heart, stimulate the movement of the blood, and the degree of mental activity stemming from such a condition is in some cases among the highest. If you're a positive person, you're happy, you think well. Maimonides, in a different place, suggests one of the ways to increase your mood as well as your mental acuity is exercise. It also parallels the fact that there was a study in the University of Manchester that those that are extremely fit can increase their IQ scores as much as 20%. If you're in good shape, you think well. It also helps stave off the aging process. According to one source, since the brain uses 20% of the oxygen we take in, a person who takes in more oxygen, does aerobic exercises, has a larger lung capacity, breathes better, thinks better. According to one study, if you're in good shape, it only can only help your mental activity. As we said, the second part is about eating. When you overeat and you're sluggish, you don't think well. You know, in there's an expression in Yiddish, Shabbos noch ein Kugel. In other words, after you eat kugel on Shabbos or chont, or you're eating a large meal, you just can't think. You're tired, you just can't think. In fact, the Talmud, there's a passage in the Dorim in Lamed Zayin Amud Beis in 37b that speaks about that, you know, you can't study with your kids on Shabbos after you have the meal. The kid's just not in the mood to learn, you know. When you overeat, it's a time to rest. In fact, it could be partially, that's the reason why it was suggested, here's on the top of page 4, that the way to acquire Torah is to have a Spartan lifestyle, or at least be willing to have a Spartan lifestyle. There's a medrash which is quoted in Tosfos, one of the medieval commentators in the Gemara Ksubas 104a, that says before a person should pray that the words of Torah knowledge should be integrated inside of him, he should pray that he not be tempted for all the good food. In other words, for all the... when you have that luxurious lifestyle, you're into eating, you're not into thinking. And perhaps one could say, I'm not positively sure, that although the Torah allows eating of meat, it's interesting to note that some of the world's greatest secular thinkers were vegetarians. Archimedes, Galileo, Leonardo da Vinci, Sir Isaac Newton, Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein. So first we mention the idea of keeping in shape. The second is don't overeat, which connected to the first thing is, of course, be in a good mood. For some lifestyle, we go into laughter. Laughter is important. Mood is important in studying Torah. It's important to get IQ, to heighten your IQ scores. They've made studies, this is on just a short-term basis, that those who listen to complex music for 20 minutes, in other words, Mozart, Beethoven, can temporarily increase their IQ scores by as much as 15 points. If you're in the right mood, you think better. Up until now, we've discussed what we call normative intelligence. Again, the type of intelligence that we would test on an IQ score. There's another part to this, which we will call inspiration. The Talmud speaks of the process of inspiration that is given, like it's a gift, it's a minor form of prophecy, which is given to the great Talmudic scholars. In order, of course, to be eligible, to be fit for this inspiration, one must be in a good mood. And we've quoted before on page 5, the idea of laughter, of El, about the divine presence only rests on a person who's in a pleasant mood, is in a happy mood. It applies for prophecy. It applies for Talmudic reasoning. And that's why, as we quoted, you can look in the English translation, that one of the great Talmudic scholars, Rabbah, before his lecture said something humorous, said a joke, put everyone in a good mood in order to set the stage for his lecture. Inspiration, as well as normative intelligence, demands being in a good mood. But there's another part of inspiration, so to speak, which is probably less supernatural. Researchers speak of what is known as a hypnagogic state. This very often one has the most productive thinking when one is right before he's going to sleep. One is relaxed. One hasn't fallen asleep, but one is in a sense removed from this world, since his unconscious, his subconscious, is connected to him. And some of the greatest creative geniuses used to solve their problems trying to use this hypnagogic state. Dr. Raymond Moody, the researcher whose landmark work, Life After Life, produced a whole genre of research and near-death experiences, recently wrote a book. The name of the book is Reunions. But in it, he speaks about this hypnagogic state. And he quotes the fact, this is that Thomas Edison would sometimes get his greatest inspiration right before he would catnap. He would almost fall asleep. But he was afraid that if he would fall asleep, he'd forget everything. So he had a steel ball in each hand and a metal dishpan below. So he would just doze off and start thinking. And when he would really doze off and his hands would relax, he would be jarred back into reality by the sound of the balls hitting the metal pans. But he would keep his memory, and this as he was falling asleep, intact. And in that state, he made some of his greatest revelations. So one can't underestimate the fact of relaxing. Just relaxing, let yourself go and think and imagine. This is like what would be called minor inspiration. G of intelligence, and let's just go quick, let's just review what we've gotten so far. The I of intelligence is intellect. The idea of the importance of intellect, the Talmud puts of the highest importance, and the fact is that we are limited in our intellect. Each of us has a finite potential. However, N says that we can, if we want, stretch ourselves. T is Talmud, which deals with that part of intelligence, which is reasoning, which we discussed really, which is closest to that type of reasoning which is tested in an IQ test. E is erudition, the idea of the importance of gaining knowledge. And it's a lifetime of gaining knowledge. L is lifestyle. If one wants to increase one's thinking ability, one should exercise, one should eat less. L, laughter, one should be in a good mood. And perhaps take a cue of listening to classic music. I, inspiration, which is, in a sense, deals with the other part of intelligence, of information coming either from the divine or at least from one's subconscious. G now is gift. We are given, as we said before, a certain amount of intelligence to start off with. And everyone has talents in a certain area of intelligence. We pray It's part of the prayers, and every day is a prayer. V'sein chelkenu b'sorosecha. Give us our portion in your Torah. Everyone has a specific portion. Some people are good at this, and some people are good at that. But everyone has a place. How can you tell what's your place? That's what you feel most comfortable with. This is the quote, really, we quote in Brachas in 43b. That area that you feel most comfortable with is the area that was your basherta, and that's your portion. The idea of gift, though, also has it. That it's a continuous gift. We spoke about N, the nerve, you can stretch yourself. Part of how you stretch yourself, how you get more intelligence and more insight, is through prayer. The Talmud speaks about the idea that one should pray privately. When one prays, one should add a private prayer. Not just the formal prayers, but add your own. That which you feel is your unique need. Rashi explained this. This is from the Talmud, this is in Avodah Zarah in 8a in Ches Amud Aleph. Gives an example of a person has a problem of forgetting. A person loves to learn, puts a lot of effort, has a problem with memory. What should a person do? He says, pray. You know, in the Amida, in the standard form of prayer, the weekday prayer, the first prayer we have is for knowledge and understanding. If you have a unique problem, speak about it there. Add your special need in that part of the prayer. So gift, the G of gift, is the idea that we are given unique gifts, but also we can ask for more. You want to know how to boost your IQ? We've discussed practice. We've discussed change in lifestyle. Another very important area is prayer. So if you really want it, pray for it. You may be very surprised. E is effort. To the extent that you try, you will be answered. This refers specifically to that wisdom which goes into the what we call Torah, which deals with which covers a very wide area of wisdom. If you try, there's a guarantee. If you really want it and you try, you'll find. And this is the quote here on the bottom of page 5. If a man says to you, I have labored and not found. Listen, I've tried, I've worked through something. No results. Don't believe him. As if he says, I haven't labored and found, don't believe him. When it refers to Torah, you want real wisdom, you want real insight. If you try, you'll get it. And if you don't try, you won't. So E refers to effort. You have to pray, you have to try. N, called nature. The IQ, what we call IQ, the intelligence which is tested, is very often the IQ, the intelligence of book learning, of academia. There's a vast area of intelligence which deals with common sense, street smarts. And that's the reason so many geniuses fail, because all their efforts are placed in gaining book knowledge. They really don't know how to deal with people. They don't have those survival skills, that genius in the way of understanding people, to negotiate, to speak, to communicate. There's a statement in midrashic sources, derech eretz kodma l'torah, the way of the land, natural wisdom comes before Torah. It was the God-given wisdom of the Torah. It's important to know derech eretz. You have to know human nature. You have to know how you should act. And in fact, really, the Talmud really is full of this. Really, the quote that we have on page 6 is from a Mishnah in Bava Basra. It's 175b. It says, this is a quote from Rabbi Yishmael on top of page 6. He who desires to become wise should engage in the study of civil law. For there's no branch of the Torah more comprehensive than they, and they are like a welling fountain. Civil law deals with litigation, deals with commerce, deals not only with the letter of the law, but deals with human psychology. Intelligence should not be confined to book learning. There's an intelligence of how to act in life. What's the right thing to say? What's the right button to push when you speak with people? So again, besides of how to boost your IQ, how it's tested, normative testing, it's important to try to cultivate that other aspect, which we call nature. The end, C, the last two, C and E, refer to the ranges of age that effort is placed to increase one's intelligence. Here we have, on C, this is on page 6, children, about the importance of learning when you're young. Because when you learn it right, you don't have to undo all the mistakes that are accumulated through a lifetime. And when you're older, it's a compare it to writing on rubbed out paper. Because now you want to learn it right, but you have this whole baggage of a lifetime. Today is we know that many of them, those who attended last time, couldn't be here tonight. Is the playoffs with the Red Wings. But if you want your children to really gain intelligence, start them young. That their focus should not just be on what we call the focus of the common culture, but with the areas that we discussed tonight. So see, children, you want to dedicate your life a life of growth. So make sure, start as soon as you can. And E, elderly, is it's never too late. Rabbi Akiva only started studying when he was 40. There are many who start even later in life. But the more you stretch yourself, the more you apply yourself, you stave off the mental deterioration that comes through old age. The quote that we have, which ends this, is the bottom page 6. Scholars, the older they grow, the more wisdom they acquire. This is taken from Shabbos, Tractate Shabbos in Talmud, Kuf Nun Beis Amud Aleph, 152a. And Amei Ha'oretz, those who are ignorant, those that don't apply themselves to intelligent endeavors, the older they get, the more foolish they get. In a sense, it's like a machine that's left out in the rain just to rust. If it's not carefully oiled and used, it deteriorates through age. Why intelligence is better than your machine, though, is that it gets better with age. The more you use it, the more wisdom you acquire. That as you grow old, the better it gets. So let's summarize what we have, and then we will go on to this IQ test And I'll end off with a story, and then we'll be open to the questions. Okay? I, for intelligence, is intellect. According to the Talmud, it's of prime importance. N is nerve. We do have limits, but you can stretch yourself if you have the chutzpah, if you have the desire. T is Talmud, and which is really what we're dealing with, real intelligence, the power of analysis, the power of thinking through, thing of questioning. When you're reading, now just don't read it, don't just skim it, but make sure you know every word and you know it well, and ask yourself, are the author's conclusions warranted? E is erudition. Increase your knowledge. It isn't enough that you have the ability, but you have to apply yourself. L is lifestyle. If you want to increase your intelligence, exercise more, eat less. L, laughter, be in a good mood. I, inspiration, there's a part of intelligence which is really goes beyond just normative thought, the conscious thought process. There's the subconscious thought process. You can access that. And this is through relaxation. Let yourself go. And of course there's the inspiration, which is a divine gift. G is the gift. We are all gifted. But we can ask for more gifts, and here is the importance of prayer. You want to boost your IQ. It says pray. E is effort. It isn't just enough to pray. You have to work. It's in tangent. It says pray, but work. And really there's a quote from the Talmud in 70 in Nafayan, that refers to the idea that you can increase your intelligence really by this dual process of effort and prayer. N is nature, which are here we're dealing with human nature. It's important, don't limit your intelligence just to book learning. It says you have to, it has to stretch out to other areas of life. Knowing people, how to interact with people. C, children. You have children, grandchildren. Make sure they begin at an early age. E, elderly, is never stop. It's never too late. And the more you apply yourself, the better you get. I would like now just briefly to go over the IQ test that we printed here. This is on page 7. Your vocabulary. What is a platitude? A platitude is a banal, trite remark, you know, that's really redundant, that you think you sound intelligent, but really you're not. Histrionic is theatrics, is theatrical, and that's why the closest word to histrionic is theatrical. The word which is the opposite of demise, of course, is birth. Verbal classification, the next section, the word which is different from the other words is outlandish. Peregrination, pilgrimage, and promenade all have to do with walking and traveling. Section 3, figure classification, the second figure, which it looks like a W, doesn't belong because it doesn't have any intersecting lines. Here on section 4, following directions, if the circle below is taller than the square and the cross is shorter than the square, put a K in the circle. This is not true. But if this is not the case, put a C in the second tallest figure, that's the cross. 5, sentence completion, and it is D. We'll just read this. Rational men must agree in the existence of a life after death. For without this, there can be no justice, no reward, for the blank is good, who through capricious fate have had a hard lot in this world, nor condemnation for those evil persons profited from their wrong acts. So the correct answer is D. Verbal analogies, section 6, is hospital is to sickness as school is to ignorance. Hospital is a place, right? Sickness is a condition, and the only one which is a place and condition is school is to ignorance. 8, here on page 8 we have section 7. Here I could not because of lack of space. In a standard IQ test, they give you something to read and there's a series of questions that have to be answered. We couldn't do this. In the series completion, select the letter that should appear next in the series. You know, you have C, B, you have C, and then it goes back, B, right? F is three letters above C and goes back to E. I is three letters above F, goes back to H. L is three letters above I, goes back to K. And O is three letters above L. Figural reasoning, which is 9, if you'll notice, there are two things that are happening with these figures. The line, which is at an angle, goes counterclockwise from the bottom left-hand side. So you would expect now the next figure, 5, should again be at the bottom, which would at least your candidates would be C, B, C, or D. Also, if you'll notice, it varies of things. There's 1.5 lines which are taken from first the bottom, then the top, then the bottom. It will be taken from the top again, and that's why C is your candidate. That's the answer is C. And again, on the 10X, show me the man you honor. I know by that symptom better than any other you are yourself, by Carlyle. It's interesting. Thomas Carlyle was a famous Scottish historian. This statement really is really, according to the commentary of the Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the great Spanish medieval commentators, this is actually the words of King Solomon in Proverbs. And of course, the correct answer is C, a man can be judged by those he emulates. Because you know a person by whom he honors, because that's what you revere or respect. So it's indicative what kind of a person you are. So really the correct answer is C. And let me finish now with a little story. I believe I've said this in a previous lecture last year. It's a beautiful story, and we'll end with this story. We've discussed up until now about intelligence, the importance of intelligence, the limits of intelligence, how if you stretch yourself, you could exceed your what would be called your normal limitations. This, as I understand, is a true story. A teacher was given a class which was severely problematic. The class, the children had learning disabilities, there were emotional problems. The teacher was not told of these problems. And in the year's time, the teacher wrought a virtual miracle and turned that whole class around. And they exceeded the wildest expectations of the administration. At the end of the school year, the teacher was called in by the principal, and the principal had just no words of praise for the teacher. You just did beyond our wildest dreams with that class. And the teacher looked at the principal, just couldn't understand. He says, "Why, these kids are brilliant kids. I just brought it out in them." And she went through the class list. She opened up her roll book. She went through the class list. Timothy Jones, 150. Mary Scott, 148. Bill Smith, 139. I mean, these are brilliant kids. Look at their IQ scores. Princess, could I take a look at that roll book? Handed the roll book to the principal. Looks at the roll book. They're not their IQ scores. They're their locker numbers. But because the teacher believed that these kids had such ability, the teacher brought out the best in these children. If you could think of yourself as a person without limits, we've discussed about various ideas of intelligence. We've touched upon the thinking process, the questioning process, the search for knowledge, the idea of prepping yourself for thinking, and putting yourself in the right mood and exercise. We spoke about inspiration and prayer. But I think also very important, as we said, is N, nerve. You have to have chutzpah. The idea of chutzpah is don't set limits for yourself. If you look at a person, look at yourself as a person without limits, you will be a person without limits. And you'll be very surprised at the results. Thank you. Now, are there any questions? And you could come to the microphones.
I have a question. What if you're ahead of your time? What if you're not recognized? Is it a blessing?
The question was, what about a person who's ahead of his time? If you're too smart for your generation, is that a blessing? Truth is, it's not a blessing. Many great men who had great ideas, the time wasn't ripe. Galileo couldn't make public his ideas. Years later, says Copernicus, was successful. Many times, great people plant ideas that are not accepted in their generation. But through their books or disciples, their ideas live on until it takes root and blossoms in later generations. The important thing is, and again, you're asking about the limits. A person has all this intelligence, all these ideas, and no one's listening to them. Right? There's a beautiful statement that's attributed to Rabbi Yisroel Salanter. Yisroel Salanter is one of the great geniuses of the 19th century. The founder, what is known as the Musar movement, was an ethical, moral movement, basically amongst Lithuanian Jews, Talmudic scholars, who made the following statement. He's speaking about results. He said it in Yiddish. He says, you don't have to imitate. You don't have to be spiteful, in other words, because you're frustrated. You don't have to have that feeling that you have to have success, and if you don't have that success in life, then you're just nothing. You have to do what's right in life. It's for God to decide if all your efforts will take root or not. But don't think, well, if what I've given or what I've tried is not successful, you're a failure. You're not a failure. Your job in life is to do. Do your best. Be sincere. Don't imitate. Don't be spiteful. Don't have high expectations. You have to do what's right. Let God do the rest. When it comes to the microphone, it's easier for people to hear.
Rabbi, does the Talmud have anything to say about intuition?
Yeah, the question was asked about what the Talmud has to say about intuition. Intuition really has a minor prophecy. And it seems very interesting that women are more gifted in intuition than men, have that sense. It's a natural sense. Sarah, the Medrash describes in Rashi, in his commentary in the Torah brings this, that Sarah, had this special gift that even Abraham didn't have. It's a special gift. Not all of us are gifted, but it is a psychic gift, and the Talmud does speak about psychic gifts. Okay, thank you very much again.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.